can stay out there for a while longer. Again, if we get a frost or when we get a frost, that's certainly a time to dig them out. But otherwise, we can start the digging process now. And if you've got a big patch, that might be just kind of space it out and you can selectively harvest.
So that's kind of an interesting timing thing for the production in your garden, that you can use that same space to grow potatoes during summer potato growing season. And then when those come out, that can be your signal that, hey, it's time to plant garlic and this is the place to do it.
Yes, some of these beds do not stay empty for very long, and even where I harvested garlic back in July and early August, those usually within a day or two, I went back and planted cover crop seed mixtures onto those beds, which helped to reduce, well, they compete with weeds that might otherwise grow into the fall and such, but they also help bind up any stray nutrients that are still there. They can be taken up, and the mixture I was using is a oats, vetch, winter peas, and fava bean mixture. And some of it I've already cut down. In fact, it's grown so well. Some of it is 6 inches to a foot tall, and then I just planted some more last week, which hopefully will get to be at least 6 inches or more tall before it gets cold. But they'll tolerate some cold too. So all of that will then get either chopped under and then will be allowed to rot, compost, over the winter. Hopefully I'll throw some seaweed on top of that, and then plastic will go over the whole thing. So that area then will be ready next year. Where there was garlic this year, may have potatoes next year, or they may have cabbages, cauliflower, broccoli, carrots, beets, who knows what else. But again, that's all part of my rotation. So you're not planting potatoes or garlic, or any of the other crops in the same bed year after year after year.
Right, right, yes. So I heard something interesting there. You were talking about the cover crops taking up remaining nutrients in the beds.
Yes, exactly.
Kind of
so that
those.
That yeah. way then it's kind of bound up in the organic matter, which then when it rots down, composts, becomes more available to the next crop. So things like phosphorus and potassium are fairly slow release, slow to become available. But if the plants take it up and into their cells and bind it with organic matter, then when it rots down, it is more quickly available compared to having the plant roots, which have to, so basically somebody else is doing the work for us, or the cover crop is doing the work, some of the work, for the next crop that comes along to make it easier for them to use those nutrients.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's so interesting. And I imagine that it also helps protect the soil from just simply leaching out those nutrients during a rainy fall season.
Exactly, so during this time, I mean, yes, I could have just covered those beds after I planted after I dug the garlic. I could have just covered them with clear plastic or black plastic, which would have done the same thing to stop the leaching. But this way I gain organic matter. But otherwise, all the nutrients that were there are still there. Next spring, I will still add some nitrogen fertilizer. I can afford to add somewhat less fertilizer because of this, you know, new organic matter, which otherwise you'd have to bring in as other compost, peat, or something else also along the way. So I'm trying to keep improving my soil and holding the nutrients that I have.
Wow, well, that is really fascinating to think about. You know, it just goes back to the importance of planning and thinking about soil quality and all of that. But boy, that's great. It's so nice this time of year when things are kind of shifting in the garden and in the soil and in your beds, where it's an opportunity to take stock of what you want to do and how to do
and
it.
And you can, again, the seaweed, you know, I've been watching for seaweed on the beaches. Not a whole lot is showing up yet. Basically, we're waiting for storms, which will loosen up the fucus, the popweed, that is the main seaweed source that we want. So in the meantime, so that will get, at some point, who knows, October, November, December, if there's no snow on the ground, mm-hmm. you know, I can go, I've got a spot where I can get to fairly easily, and I can haul this stuff, and even, well, I've done it every month of the year, weather permitting, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So, and all of that is good for, you know, good for the potatoes, it's good for the raspberries and the blackberries and currants and gooseberries and everything, and or adding seaweed to your compost. So,
is there any kind of hot tips that people should keep in mind when they're going out to collect popweed? Are there any conditions or areas that, in general, people should avoid or anything like that? Or is it all...
I suppose there's... If you knew that there was an upland area above that seaweed-collecting beach that was contaminated with oil and other nasty chemicals, you know, potentially that would be an area to avoid.
Okay.
Otherwise, though, I mean, there are different kinds of seaweed, though, again, the popweed is the most common one. There'll be the bull kelp,
mm-hmm.
And several others that are possibly available. So they're all good. They, you know, they're all a good source for the micronutrients that we want. All the stuff that, you know, again, because they're in the ocean, they are concentrating nutrients, minerals, and stuff which wash off the land. So again, that's one of the reasons why we don't want to be taking that stuff from an area that may be contaminated, or if there's, you know, something that has leached into the soil over past years, you know, below a dump site,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. And there's actually one of those up in Haines you may have driven by if you've been to Haines and come into town from the ferry terminal, where the old tank farm is an upland area. It's fenced. I mean, it's perfect, wonderful. It'd be, you know, great developable property, except that it is very contaminated.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, it's a gentle, south-facing slope, perfect location for gardening or, you know, farming or for building houses on, as far as that goes. But it's fenced off, and it's a no-go area. So, again, and there's a lovely beach down below it, and people do haul seaweed from there, and people do, they set crab pots down there in that area, in the water, in the ocean below it.
Hmm.
And I haven't seen test results, say, of water quality, crab, you know, crabs, mussels, clams, that sort of thing, what there might be in there. But that would be an area that to be avoided, basically.
Right. Yeah, that seems like a good rule of thumb. And, yeah, I hope folks are being careful out there when they're harvesting, like you say, things that are concentrating runoff from the land.
Mm-hmm. Right. But anyway, meanwhile, back to our potatoes, which started on, sort of.
Uh-huh.
So we want to be, we look at our plants and different varieties mature at different times.
Mm.
So, and if you go in a catalog, it'll say there's early and mid-season and late potatoes. So normally the early ones are mature sooner. Usually it also means that they don't store as long. So you get them out of the ground, you eat them, you try to store them as long as possible if you've got good conditions for that. We'll talk about that too. So digging the potatoes, we want to do that carefully. I mean, I use various implements if my soil is loose enough. When I was helping a lady up in Haines do it, we were digging, you know, we were pretty much going through the loose, nice high ridges by hand, mm-hmm. and pulling out the potatoes. And certainly I have speared, it seems like we always spear the biggest and best and most beautiful potato if we're using a, you know, a digging fork or potato fork or something like that, or a shovel.
Right.
So if we can, at least try to loosen things up gently and sneak in from deep underneath and lift up the soil so that the potatoes just sort of gently fall out of there, and then we can transfer them into buckets and tubs and trays and that sort of thing from there. It's worthwhile looking at, as we're harvesting, particularly if you're thinking ahead to saving some of these potatoes for next year's planting, that you see that, well, these are really nice, productive, clean-looking potatoes. It's strange. This hill produced a whole lot. This produced, like 4 or 5 pounds, and this one produced only a pound or two. Maybe we want to do our selection from those most productive ones,
mm-hmm.
And then, so you've got multiple trays that you're sorting into as you're digging, perhaps. But then also, when you go to wash your potatoes, rinse the soil off them, again, then we can see, is there scab on the potatoes? Are there other diseases, cracks? You know, we'll sort out those damaged potatoes, scabby potatoes, that will be used, consumed as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. Because if they're damaged, they won't store as well. Potentially bacteria, fungus, and other stuff can get into them, so they might rot. You wouldn't want to put them into storage where they might then contaminate your choice prime potatoes that you want to last, well, hopefully into March or April for next year.
Mm-hmm. And so the scabby ones, is it simply that they're going to decay faster, or is that scab going to be passed on to their descendants in next year's potato hills?
Both.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you wouldn't want to take scab potatoes that you can see scab, and it's they look like pustules, look like very bad case of acne or worse, and they're very rough skin. And what that the result of that is, you've got all these breaks in the skin of the potato, which means then that moisture can evaporate, can be left, and then those potatoes will dry up and shrivel more quickly, or they can also be more easily infected by other disease, fungus, and such. So, again, those might rot sooner. So, we want to, again, we're setting those aside. We're high grading. We're sorting as we go. And if we like small potatoes for planting, like a ping pong ball size up to maybe egg size, well, those are going to get set aside, and they're all going to be the nicest and cleanest of our potatoes that we want to save. And then all of these, pretty much all of them anyway, other than the ones we're going to eat immediately or very quickly, should go, once they're washed, get them to dry and move them into a dry area indoors, out of the light, and maybe put some cardboard or newspaper or something over the trays of potatoes so they can dry out and so that the skins can then toughen up. That's the curing process that we want to aim for, so that once they go into storage, then they don't dry out too quickly in storage, and then you go in there in December or January and you've got shriveled up potatoes in there, or very wrinkly potatoes, which, yeah, they're kind of edible, but they're not aesthetically appealing.
Right. So one more time, you're curing the potatoes before storing them.
Yes, exactly. Before putting them away into, so when I say I've had my potatoes out of the ground in my garage, drying out for a couple weeks is nice, and undercover. So then from there, I'm going to probably be sorting again. You know, I may have missed some bad potatoes along the way, and some of them may have been have changed their appearance somewhat. So then I go, they put them into paper bags, you know, paper grocery bags, which then go into boxes and then into my root cellar. And I've got them labeled as far as variety goes. Mm-hmm. So then that way they can, if I want a certain kind of potato for baking or boiling or frying or roasting, I can go to, assuming my stacks aren't piled too high, I can easily go to a certain kind of potato that I want to use for different meals.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. When you're curing them, do they need to lie flat without any, you know, with room around each individual potato? Or what's the best practice?
Well, okay, we want good air circulation. That's kind of what you're aiming for. So if I've got trays that, I mean, they might be stacked two or three high, and, you know, potatoes on top of potatoes, assuming they've been well washed. Mm-hmm. And they're so that they can, we wouldn't want to have them, say, in a full bucket of potatoes, because those on the bottom aren't going to dry out well in there before we go to store them. So, yeah, you would want them only two or three potatoes deep at most, again, so you get good air circulation. So, again, if we're putting something on top of those potatoes to stop them from getting light, you know, we want to keep light off the potatoes so they don't turn green. And so we may even have, if we can, say you've got some 2x4s you can lay down on the floor of your garage or basement or wherever they're being curing, And so air can circulate underneath those trays, whatever you've got them in. Planting trays work great. I mean, they're perforated.
Right.
And that's what I normally use for this curing process.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Yep, planting trays. And while they're curing, you want it a warmer environment than where you store them.
Yes, exactly. So 40s to 50s, even into low 60s is fine. So, you know, some people have... We're getting toward the challenge of, okay, where are you going to keep them? So the curing part isn't too bad, but do you have a garage that's cool enough but doesn't freeze? Or do you have a crawl space that stays cool but doesn't freeze? That's the critical thing. Having the storage temperature, ideally, would be 40 degrees or below. If you've got space in a, say you've got an old refrigerator in your garage, that can work, but then you don't want to have both fruit and potatoes, root crops, in the same refrigerator, because the fruit gives off their own ripening, well, chemical called ethylene gas, which can age and stimulate the potatoes to sprout. So again, you've got to make some choices there. What are you storing near what?
Right.
Or if you've got a root cellar, and again, potentially fruit can go in there, but then you'd have to make sure you've got a fan and some ventilation in there so that the ethylene gas doesn't build up. That's the same stuff that bananas give off,
right,
which can be used to help ripen other fruits if need be.
Right.
So again, you're not likely to be storing bananas with your potatoes because the bananas don't like the cold temperatures.
Right.
But that's worth thinking about in your planning for in your storage area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are great tips.
There's another way that we can start the curing process, actually outdoors in the garden bed. So again, say I can look at my potatoes and say, well, this box is ready to harvest now or this weekend. Those are still nice and green, so I can leave those for a while longer. Well, what I can do is kind of help the drying starting the curing process by cutting back the vines, cut the potato plants off, remove them, put them onto your burn pile, don't put them in your compost, and then you can put over them some plastic or a tarp, and that process, once you remove those tops from the potatoes, then the potatoes are going to start that curing process in the soil. The other idea is that we're trying to keep them a little drier. We're not letting Mother Nature rain on them continuously for weeks on end. So you can do this for about a week to 2 weeks, again, to kind of start the curing process. And particularly if you just aren't ready, don't have that much time to dedicate to digging all your potatoes this weekend, perhaps, or tomorrow, or whenever that happens to be that you're going to do it. So that, again, if you can space out your harvest time, that gives you more time to work on the digging, the curing, and the storage, and then you get one batch into your boxes. You know, you're kind of rotating. You may only have so much space for curing potatoes. So, again, you can get one batch cured into their boxes, and here comes the next batch to take over that space.
Nice. Okay, great. That makes so much sense. So you can either start or, you know, substantially get a lot of the work done of curing right there in the ground. And remind us one more time, what are we looking for in the plant that's above the soil to let us know that, okay, the potatoes are ready to either have these tops cut off and start curing in the hill or come out and cure wherever? Potato plant going to look like?
So they should have long since finished blossoming, although, when was it, 2 weeks ago I was in Haines and a friend of mine had potatoes that still had flowers on them. So.
Wow.
Anyway, no hurry on those. They were nice and green. They could stay there.
Okay.
So the other ones, though, you know, fully mature, still dark green, those are good to probably leave for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They're starting to turn yellow, or they're some of them, I mean, some of mine were basically dried. No, not dried. They were dead anyway. Mm-hmm. The tops were dead. Definitely that's an indication that they are ready.
Right.
Or at least curing and perhaps digging also. So again, once the plants are dying down, it's time to get them out of the ground.
Right.
And unfortunately, I found out that You know, I rotate my crops, but even so, and start with nice, clean, new potatoes. But I did have potato scab on some of them. Mm-hmm. So, and I know, unfortunately, that once they have scab, I need to make a note of that in my, you know, my garden log records. Mm-hmm. That this bed does have scab, so even, and it stays there. It's going to be there. So even if I rotate, you know, don't plant potatoes in that box for 3 more years, 5 more years, I come back, plant potatoes again, then I'm still likely to get some scab on those, that new batch of stuff, unless I am planting scab-resistant varieties. And unfortunately, I found out one of the varieties I thought was scab-resistant got some scab this year. So I'm disappointed in that.
So you can rotate out.
Some that I grow, a cup I can recommend that don't get scab, Magic Myrna, which is a bright yellow-fleshed potato with red skin and yellowish eyes, and Gold Rush, which is a russet potato. You know, most of the russets are scab-resistant. But again, look at the catalogs if you're choosing potatoes for next year, and if you know that you have scab in your soil and you still want to plant potatoes, I mean, we need potatoes for our diet, in my view, you're just going to have to make some choices. Either put up with the scab or try to grow scab-resistant varieties.
Right, right. So it's either switch potato varieties to something that's explicitly scab-resistant or, you know, do the hard thing and chuck that soil.
Well, I mean, you can still, yeah, I wouldn't get rid of the soil because you can still grow carrots, beets, cabbages, broccoli, lettuce, all that, peas, and all that stuff in that soil.
Gotcha.
It's just, it's more a matter of that's a choice you're making what to plant there. So it's still okay soil.
Okay.
The scab organism doesn't affect other plants, most of our garden plants in there. So it's just, you know, it's quite specific to potatoes.
Okay. That's good.
You can change, you can modify scab. Well, you know, the recommendations include making sure you have very acid soil because scab doesn't like that to grow in. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, and there are acid, I've been told and read that there is scab which is tolerant of acid soil. So adding more sand, getting better drainage in your soil can reduce the scab. Being careful not to mix manure, especially not very much well-composted manure, in the soil, again, can stimulate scab organisms. So again, if you're going to add manure into your soil, say this fall, the plants that you would put in next year should be most likely a leafy green, like cabbages, broccoli, Swiss chard, lettuce, that kind of stuff, rather than root crops like potatoes and carrots.
Okay, that makes sense. That's a good tip. So that's for using manure as fertilizer and composted manure?
Right. So the more completely composted it is, the better in general. But sometimes we may not have that choice. Sometimes we're, like I've talked about, building new boxes with kind of fresh manure and then soil on top of that. That wouldn't be a place you would want to plant the potatoes and carrots. You would want to make sure that stuff gets a chance to fully break down over the course of the next year or so, so the worms and the good microorganisms and other stuff get to break that stuff down into better compost that potatoes might be tolerant of and hopefully not get scab. Again, that's keeping the records as far as what you have, what you've put into your beds, unless you've got a really terrific memory, and I cannot claim that anymore. It used to be pretty good, but I'm getting more mature, so my memory isn't what it used to be.
Well, I mean, it's a good thing to always kind of pound home. You know, I think listeners of the program have heard us say it a lot of times, but planning in the garden and note-taking is huge to have a healthy, productive, ongoing garden. And this is just a great example of why that really is necessary.
Yeah, I surprised my wife this summer when she came home one day, and here I'd painted numbers on some of my boxes. I have never done that before. I just described the box. This is the third box above the power pole, or the second box over from the driveway going over to my neighbor's, and now I've got numbers on boxes. And So again, maybe making, if you can make the record keeping easier, it's more likely to happen.
That's a good point. That's so true. Yep. Yeah, that is a great tip. Well, those are some excellent ideas around potatoes, and I hope people have gleaned a lot. Are there any last thoughts on potatoes that we want to pound home there?
Just enjoy. I mean, enjoy your potatoes. Come up with some new recipes. And, I mean, potato soup and all the different kinds of stews that are coming along with, I know it's moose season and deer season. And, of course, chowder is always popular with salmon and halibut and rockfish and whatever. Mm. So, I mean, there's so many things that we can do with potatoes. Chuck, my mother used to make donuts. She would make mashed potatoes, I mean, and with a yeast. And of course, yeast really likes, you know, yeast gets along well with the potato starch also. Hmm. He made these just incredible donuts, which I have never made, you know, using mashed potatoes and plus the flour and all that. And they were incredible. I mean, fond memories that I should try them someday, but have yet to do. So there's... Yeah. And they do, if we're not getting quite so carried away using so much butter and so much salt and all the rest of it, potatoes really are very nutritious for us, though we may not want to eat as much as the hardworking Irish and Scots used to do back in the early 1800s when they talk about a working man would eat up to 8 pounds of potatoes a day.
Ay, ay, ay.
Well, okay, so when the potato blight came along and killed off, you know, caused rotting potatoes to rot, I mean, that's why.
Yeah.
That's a big reason why people starved.
Right. Yeah. Well, gosh. Well, that's a testament to their nutritiousness at Wednesday.
Go down to look at an 8-pound bag of potatoes. And can you eat that much in a day? Because they were working really hard, too, you know. 12 to 16-hour days, but that's a lot.
Yeah, they must have been working hard. Potato bellies. Jeez. Well, those potatoes, we love them. They are extremely useful, that's for darn sure. Well, I have a question here from a listener before we sign off that we might run this one by you. It's relatively... simple question. You still there, Ed?
I'm here. I'm waiting for it.
Okay. Building up the suspense there. Okay. Question is, when is the best time to take a trimming from a golden chain tree?
Take a trimming as to try to propagate it?
I think so, yeah.
Is that the assumption? Okay. For a lot of... And I haven't done it. I plant golden chain trees, bring them in and sell them. But I'm going to throw this. I'm not entirely sure. But for a lot of cuttings, trying to root cuttings, a lot of times they'll say to use a softwood cutting, which is probably June, July, when the new growth would be, say, 4 to 5 inches long, have several leaves on it. That's when I've taken cuttings from other plants. I've not, with some plants you can take dormant cuttings, I mean, like currants, gooseberries, willows, dogwoods. You just take a cutting now or in January, stick it in soil in a warm place and it'll grow roots.
Yeah.
But for this, since I don't have specific practice with that one, the softwood cuttings, you would take something that has usually maybe 3 leaves on it, a 4 to 6 inch long cutting, trim off all but one leaf, most likely, and then using one of the rooting hormones, whether it be a powder or gel or liquid, dip the cutting into that and into either clean potting soil or clean sand, clean perlite or vermiculite, right, or root. Mm-hmm. Again, it would be easy to look that up specifically online for how to root golden chain trees. And they'll say for things that are more difficult to root, like rhododendrons, they actually use bottom heat. They have heating blankets or heating pads that go underneath the trays or pots that have these plants in them. So again, there's lots the research has probably been done, and so it's a matter of, you know, it's all out there on the internet to go looking for. So that's what I'm going to suggest folks do. They may very well have some specific, more specific information than I can give.
Right. Well, yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, those are great general tips, though. That yeah, softer
so
wood.
Timing does make a difference. That's right. The basic, and you know how you make the cutting. So again, different plants. Some are very easy to root. Some are much more challenging than others.
Hmm. Okay, I think that's a good answer. And maybe we'll leave with that, but we'll pick it up again next week. How does that sound?
Okay, sounds good. One more thing I'll mention, at least with golden chain trees,
yeah,
they do have seed pods. They're a pea, in the pea family. So although probably, I don't know if you'd be able to find any seeds left yet from those still hanging on the trees or not, but that would be worth looking at also if it's a mature tree that the person is trying to take cuttings from. That's another option that they do grow. I know I've seen them. I've grown them from seed. But they are also very attractive, remarkably attractive to slugs. So you would want to. I've seen slugs climbing golden chain trees to chew on leaves. So almost like these caterpillars that I'm looking at in front of me here walking across my driveway.
Yeah. Wow, really? So having golden chains is something to think about with proximity to, like, your vegetable garden?
I don't know that I'd worry too much about the vegetable garden, but certainly small trees like seedlings or cuttings, you would want to take care and have slug bait or something like that around them.
Gotcha.
To protect them if you're planting them out into the garden to grow them up into a bigger size before planting them out into your landscape somewhere.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Wow, that's a great tip. And is there going to be, like, a visual or noticeable difference between a golden chain started from a rooted trimming versus one from a seed? Does the seed do a clone?
Shouldn't be. Unlike something like an apple tree where we are usually, they're complex hybrids. The golden chains are not. They're I don't know if I'd say a simple species, but I wouldn't expect much variation there. There may be a difference in how long it takes to get to flowering time. That's pretty common from seed versus cuttings. So a cutting from a mature tree, even though it's just the tip of a new growth, is probably going to flower more quickly than a seedling. But I mean, that's kind of generally true. But again, I just haven't done as that much with golden chain trees. So
yeah, well, it's an interesting thing to think about, but yeah.
It's another experiment in the gardening season. There's no lack of experiments for us to try.
Right. If you try it both ways, jot down some notes.
Yep.
Cool. Well, okay, let's leave it there, and we'll pick it up again next week, Ed.
All right. Very good, Orin.
Okay. Take care.
Yep. Bye.
All right. It's been another great episode of In the Garden with Master Gardener Ed Bajarski, coming to us by telephone from Juneau. We sure do appreciate his expertise and his willingness to share it with us here in the community. And we appreciate the Flower Farm for helping support this program. They're located out there at 6 Rory Road, Papke's Landing. Every day but Wednesday they're open, and you can mosey on down and check out their amazing greenhouses. And they've got perennials, trees, shrubs, dirt, and mulching bark. And, they've got their famous bouquets with delivery. You can get a subscription to those bouquets, even. Anyway, that's the Flower Farm, 772-3464. And this has been In the Garden, Master Gardener Ed Bajarski, and yours truly. Nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs, you can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on a side, put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What will life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
see. When I die, don't bury me in a box in a cemetery. Out in the garden be much better, and I could be